next labeled cause of death. Gunshot to left chest. I swayed a little on my feet. At the time, I was happy in Europe, far from the oppressive heat of strip malls and liquor stores in Southern California. But the notion of a gunshot blast in Dad's little apartment brought back all the hot and stifling emotion I associated with L.A. It was jarring, revelatory, alien, bizarre. Mom and I saw each other every year or so, either in Germany or in L.A. We had suffered a lot together, but we rarely talked about the past. We maintained a warm and cordial relationship. The unspoken idea was to keep from dramatizing our troubles, to keep from wallowing. I saw the drawbacks to this very German arrangement as well as the benefits. I wasn't Californian enough to insist on talking it out, but the alternative was a closet skeleton secrecy, a habit of suppression. In high school, I had suspected Mom of denial, of covering something up with her cheerfulness and her relentless California pleasures, but after a while I realized the white wine and the games of tennis belonged to a conscious method of moving on. A month after I had ordered the certificate, Mom happened to visit Berlin. I brought up the suicide over dinner at a small restaurant. She said, "Oh, yes," as if she'd been meaning to mention it all this time. "Was there a note?" I said. "No note." And I guess we didn't need one. What had happened was clear. Gutting and tragic, unspeakably bleak. But in part of my mind, for decades, perhaps I already knew. Chapter 7. One night, Ahmed Dirye came into our room and pointed at me. "Come on," he said. "Get up." He expected me to bolt to attention. I made a point of adjusting my sling, pulling on each sock and shoe, and gathering my spare items for wherever we were headed. Raleigh groaned at my recalcitrance and muttered, "Not make them angry, Michael." Together with Mohammed Talil, the reedy group leader from our forest camp, Ahmed Dirye held my elbow and walked me across a sandy waste of weeds and goat droppings, away from Mussolini's farmhouse to the newer, more thickly settled area where slab houses stood in rows. As a free man, I had eaten lunch in this neighborhood with Gerlach and Ashwin. The moon was bright, the air was misted with brine, and to our left I noticed a blinking light on top of Hobbio's cell phone tower. We passed a Somali in a collared shirt, sitting on a berm of sand. I recognized Ali Dulai and moved toward him, but the others steered me away and led me along a compound wall where they unlocked a clanking door. The house had raw concrete floors and slab walls painted powder blue. No furniture. A plastic-wrapped mattress and pillow waited for me on the floor of one room. It was a safe house, new-looking but barren, half-built, maybe waiting for a spurt of ransom cash to finish construction. By the light of a fluorescent lantern, I unwrapped the mattress and tried to make myself comfortable. A generator rumbled in the distance. Was this new arrangement a response to the riot outside Mussolini's farmhouse? A new phase of captivity? Or just softer accommodation for the American? I didn't like one option better than the others, and while I pulled the thin blanket around my shoulders and tried to sleep, the generator stirred up dreams of helicopters and deliverance by gunfire. I called this place Mohammed's house because Talil seemed to be in charge. The guards acted mild-mannered, less intentionally cruel. They let me sit outdoors in the afternoon. They spread mats on the porch and offered me cigarettes and khat. A good group. I resisted the khat even when I felt depressed since I didn't want to pick up a habit. But once in a while, with a bottle of mango juice or a glass of oversweet tea, I allowed myself the pleasure of a cigarette in the prison yard. One morning on the porch, I noticed some useful items scattered on the pirate's mat, not just Kalashnikovs and khat, but also cigarette lighters, pens, and grade school notebooks. The guards used these notebooks to keep track of their shifts. The young pirate named Hersey offered me a cigarette. When I lit up, I noticed that his lighter had an LED at one end. "Can I keep this?" I said.
"Ha, yes."
Hersey flipped through a menu of songs on his phone. Pirate phones provided several forms of entertainment and distraction, not just songs, but also video clips and recorded Sufi sermons. "Gnan," he said, and played something by the Somali-Canadian rapper. The song Hersey had chosen, "Until the Lion Learns to Speak," resembled a Somali folk song I had noticed in the pirate's SUV. It had the same call and response, the same urgent, falling rhythm. But the Somali version sounded more traditional. Hersey and another guard talked about Kanan in excited voices. A translator named Eunice, who sat with us on the porch, said, "They are his cousins." "Both of them?" I weighed the likelihood in my mind. "Both Hawaii?" "Yes." "Are you all Sa'ad?" I said. "Yes," he said. I didn't care very much. "This group, the good group, is Sa'ad," he said. "The big group is Hawaii and Darod." "A mix of clans," I said. "Yes." "Can I borrow this notebook?" I said. "Yes." I scrounged a pen, too, and retreated to my room, where I started a journal. From the radio, I learned the date and made small notes about each day. But I had to restrict the writing to an hour or so at a time because it bothered my wrist. One afternoon, I took notes on a fascinating BBC report about spy plane flights over Somalia. The correspondent flew with the Royal Australian Air Force over the pirate-infested waters off the Horn of Africa. Its P-3 Orion amounted to an airborne surveillance station stuffed with equipment and analysts. Every morning, these enormous planes lumbered out along predetermined paths from Bahrain in the Persian Gulf, which told me that my guest-at location on any given day would be one stop on a long, bureaucratic mission. This gave me an idea. I figured drones were overhead, too, somewhere out of sight, so I started going to the bathroom with Hersey's cigarette lighter in my shorts pocket. The sky at dawn and sunset was dusky enough to make a sharp LED shine like a dim little star, I hoped. So I aimed the light through a toilet paper tube to hide the glare from my guards and flashed SOS at the sky in Morse code. To my surprise, it seemed to work. Surveillance planes started cruising low over Hobyo every other day. One afternoon, while I sat on the porch, I became aware of a distant buzz, strengthening over Hobyo like the noise we'd heard over the forest. Hersey's eyes widened. "Michael! AC!" They hustled me into my bedroom and closed the dented shutters. The pirates called these aircraft AC as shorthand for AC-130. The C-130 Hercules is a workhorse transport plane, similar in size to an Orion, but it can be outfitted for harder jobs, and a variant called the AC-130 gunship had hunted Somali jihadists in a battle for Ras Kamboni near Kenya in 2007. The carnage was so notorious, I think the pirates knew no other name. Each room in Mohammed's house was a cube of concrete. The prospect of a raid sending bullets around in the dark tended to paralyze me. The less confusion, I thought, the better. One morning I drew a map of the compound in my notebook. I wrote in block letters that I slept alone in this room, while guards slept in this and that room. 7 guards total, I wrote, and slipped the page into my shorts pocket. "Kadi," I said. The men stood at attention with their rifles and watched me cross the yard. I locked the outhouse door and unfolded my map. No drones or planes were visible, but I knew the rumor that certain spy satellites could read license plates from orbit. It was an antiquated rumor, maybe an urban myth, but my notebook page was almost the size of an American license plate, and I had nothing better to do. For the next week, I unfolded the map on every trip to the bathroom. I made a point of taking a piss at the same time every morning, around 6, because my only hope for such a desperate plan would be regular habit. I doubted a drone analyst would just stumble across an image of me flashing vital information from a compromising position, but if the LED signals drew attention to the house, and operators learned when to watch for my toilet runs, well, after a while, I thought, we might get somewhere. Chapter 8. My guards had a knee-jerk terror of aircraft, matched by a wild and defiant bravado, as you would too if you had to worry about a SEAL raid. I tried to imagine what they were thinking. The history of Somalia's bloody relationship to air power stretched back further than Ras Kamboni or the Battle of Mogadishu. It dated to 1920, when a squadron of Royal Air Force planes landed in British Somaliland. In those days, Few people on Earth had seen flying machines of any kind, but Douglas James Jardine, the military chronicler of Britain's imperial adventure in Somalia, pointed out that the Z Squadron's arrival in Berbera caused very little stir. The average unsophisticated Somali, instead of expressing surprise and admiration at such a remarkable invention of modern science as the aeroplane, gave but a passing glance at the machines, and remarked that the Somali would also build aeroplanes, if he only knew how. That's from Jardine's colorful but colonialist 1923 book, The Mad Mullah of Somaliland. It describes the British war against Sayyid Mohammed Abdullah Hassan, who filled the same role in the Western imagination in the early 1900s that Osama bin Laden occupied a century later. According to Jardine, Sayyid Mohammed traded upon the avarice and superstitions of his fellow countrymen to convert them into robbers and cutthroats. Maybe, but a lot of Somalis still consider him a national hero. Sayyid Mohammed came from the Ogaden, northeast of Galkayo, and his fighters were Somali herdsmen who gave up traditional clan allegiances to become dervishes or Sufi devotionalists. He stirred his men through fiery sermons to a spiritual-political cause. With all the corrosive invective of the born agitator and the recklessness of the reformer, wrote Jardine, he inveighed against the luxury of the age. He proclaimed that the Somalis were wasting their substance on riotous living, especially on tea drinking. He protested against the immorality of chewing cat or the gluttony of gorging the fat of sheep's tail. Sayyid Mohammed's odd strain of Sufism had historic links to Wahhabism, which means that Sufi mysticism and Salafi fundamentalism aren't mutually exclusive in this part of the world. Somalia has absorbed larger or smaller waves of fundamentalist influence from the Arabian Peninsula for at least 200 years. The most recent wave started in the 80s, when Somali migrants moved north for Saudi service jobs. Some came home radicalized. The more I thought about the tidy categories Kapuscinski had noticed in North Africa, the more they tended to blur. There was a spectrum of Muslim belief, and a tincture of Wahhabism and Somali Sufism accounted for Sayyid Mohammed's dervish holy war. His logic, toward the British in any case, was irrefutable. In 1903, Sayyid Mohammed wrote, "I have no cultivated fields, no silver or gold for you to take. You gained no benefit by killing my men and my country is of no good to you. If you want wood and stone, you can get them in plenty. There are also many ant heaps. The sun is very hot. All you can get from me is war. If you wish peace, go away from my country to your own." Sayyid Mohammed wanted to liberate his people from Europe and unify them under Islam, and he gave the British 17 more years of sporadic war until London decided to solve the dervish problem with aircraft. The Z Squadron's bombing raids in the early 1920s were a military experiment, the first Western air assaults in Africa. Sayyid Mohammed and his dervishes were far from prepared. One dervish told him the incoming planes were chariots of Allah come to take the mullah up to heaven. Another declared them a Turkish invention from the Great War, bringing tidings of triumph from Istanbul. Sayyid Mohammed believed this man, put on his best clothes, and went out to meet the messengers. "Then the first bomb fell," wrote Jardine. "One advisor was killed outright, and the mullah's garments were singed. Thus the first shot all but ended the campaign." Sayyid Mohammed's dream of a united Somalia ended that afternoon in the desert. He survived until the end of 1920, only to die of the flu. Chapter 9. One day I sat with Eunice and Hersey on the porch, drinking from a bottle of mango juice and trying to enjoy the sunshine. Hersey handed me a stem of khat. "He wants to know if you are his friend," said Eunice. "He says he makes sure that you have mango juice and tuna fish every morning. He says you are his sahib." "Mm-hmm," I said. "He says we may not get so much payment for protecting you in this house, not as much as we thought. He wants to know if you will send him $10,000 when you are free." I cleared my throat and thought about it. "Of course," I said at last, and Hersey looked surprised. "Yes," he said. "If it gets me out tomorrow, he can have my firstborn." Eunice and Hersey conferred. "He says he would rather have the money," said Eunice. I shrugged and sipped my mango juice. Dry tree branches growing over the compound wall wavered in an ocean breeze. I heard cattle groan beyond it, some kind of cow or buffalo.
"Hersey wants to know," said Eunice finally, "if you have ever had sex with a woman with a clit."
I nearly spat my mango juice across the porch.
"He wants to know if you can bring him one," he added.
"A girlfriend with a clitoris?"
"Yes."
Somehow Eunice knew the slang word better than the real one. I squinted at him.
"You mean because all the girls in Somalia are circumcised?" I said.
"Don't men in Somalia support this tradition?"
"I think it is not so much fun," Eunice confessed.
"Why do Somalis do it?"
"It is in the Quran."
I shook my head.
"No, it isn't, Eunice."
"It is the law in all Muslim lands," Eunice informed me.
"That's not true," I said. "It's not the law in Indonesia. Some of them do it, but it's not the law."
"You have experienced," Eunice said, "or you have read."
I smiled.
"I have read, but I've been there. Indonesians are Sufis too, you know, same as Somalis. Most don't cut their women."
Eunice shook his head.
"I think this is not true," he said.
"Do you have a Quran?"
"No."
"You have to show me the passage where your religion orders Muslims to do this thing. In fact, some parts of the Hadith encourage it, but not the Quran. It's a custom from thousands of years ago, Eunice, from ancient Egypt, before Islam." I was agitated now. "If Somalis didn't cut their women, Somalia would be a happier place." My guards wavered. They weren't sure it wasn't true, but there was no convincing them. Once, in another lifetime, I had received a nice pair of sandals from an activist in California who had appreciated a column of mine arguing against female circumcision. But around here, where my clever ideas might have made some difference, I had no clout. At last I retreated to my room. The whole compound at Mohammed's house had a terrible insect problem. Over my mattress I'd assembled a gauzy mosquito tent, which served as a retreat from all insects, the carnivorous daytime flies as well as mosquitoes at night. The patio conversation about firstborn children made me brood about my bachelor life in Berlin, my own lack of children, and my dad. I sat in the tent and started to scribble. For 30 years, I thought my father had died of a heart attack, and for almost as long I had maintained awareness of our domestic life in Northridge, our model family which had not filled him with understanding or joy. Alcohol and pills had eroded both. But before he killed himself, he had started to question why he worked for Lockheed, why he lived in the San Fernando Valley at all. At heart, he was a 50s-style dad who liked to camp and fish, an American romantic about the wilderness, and I remembered sitting with him in his rattling Volkswagen one hot afternoon, waiting for a red light to turn, while he gazed out the windshield through a pair of sunglasses with a look of half-astonished disgust. He took in the vast boulevard, the traffic, maybe the smog in the sky. At last he looked at me.
"I wonder how much of our lives we waste sitting at stoplights," he said.
This memory startled me in Somalia. His desolation before he died must have been bottomless. I had pursued a different career because of his disenchantment. I had defined myself against my father to dodge the frustrations and disillusionments that had strained his heart. I preferred cities over suburbs. I liked exotic travel. I tried to avoid most addictive drugs and eat low-cholesterol food. I thought these habits would save me from a death like his. When I learned it wasn't a heart attack, of course, I still believed, without thinking too hard, that my career choices might keep me from suicide. The irony appalled me now. I scribbled and scribbled. I wrote that Dad would have opposed my career. He would have hollered and yelled. And here, in a place where I had a strong and relevant opinion about female circumcision, I had no power to change a goddamn thing. But I also noticed that my notebook was becoming an essential refuge in prison. The stress of captivity had turned my mind into a cauldron of contradictory ideas. Frustration, self-hatred, surprising impulses to violence, and nothing but the discipline of composition could lead me out of the soup. When I thought about it like that, I could answer the criticisms. In his voice that rose in my imagination while I sat alone under the mosquito tent, these nightmarish and unanswerable condemnations from beyond the grave. "Writing is impractical, selfish, narcissistic, and soft,"
Maybe, but I had found pleasure in it as a young man because it could reframe a scrambled mind. Good writing could be a release from narcissism, a declaration of independence, a way to order and furnish the mental prison. You're not real independent now, are you? No, Dad, not exactly. Thanks for asking.
Chapter 10.
On a warm night in February, the men at Mohammed's house woke me up by the glare of a fluorescent lantern and crammed me into a Land Rover. They bristled with weapons and ammunition. Talil drove us out of Hobyo and across the moonlit waste for more than an hour. A strong beam of light flashed across the bush like a beacon, and Talil aimed for it until we pulled beside a pair of unknown cars. Eunice and Talil then grasped my elbows and walked me to a cluster of 8 or 10 Somalis squatting in the dust.
"Hello, Michael," a plump man said. "My name is Mohammed." I wore nothing but thin cotton shorts and a T-shirt. I felt vulnerable and terrified. The boss in the middle, sitting cross-legged, had fat cheeks and a peculiar squint, heavy-lidded and insolent. He acted groggy, like a man who needed his cut, and he drew a pall of quiet menace around himself, a fear I could sense from his gunman. He spoke in a high, almost childish voice.
"We will make a phone call," he told me, "to someone who can help with your case. You must tell him that I need a letter from President Obama. It must request that I will be the main negotiator for your case, and it must declare me innocent of your kidnapping. It must have an official seal from the White House."
"I'll need your full name," I said.
"Just tell them, Mohammed, that is enough," he said, "and you must tell them that these pirates want their money right now. It is very important."
"How much is the demand?" I said.
$20 million.
I felt sick to my stomach. The outrageous demand was still in place. After a month of captivity, nothing had changed. The boss dialed a private American negotiator on his orange glowing Samsung. The number placed the negotiator in Washington, D.C., and the voice on the phone was sane and good-humored. It calmed me to hear clarity in my own language after so many weeks of confusion.
"The gentleman who handed you the phone, is that the first time you're meeting him?" said the negotiator, "or you've chatted with him before?"
"No, it's the first time." "That's the main guy in charge, just so you know. That's Mohammed Garfanji," he said, and my vision swam. My blood felt just like ice water. Until then, Garfanji had been a phantom, a figment of a rumor, and it weakened me to think that I was at his mercy.
"Has he made a demand?" the negotiator asked.
"Yes, he wants $20 million and some kind of form letter from the White House."
"Signed by Obama," Garfanji shouted. "It must say I am innocent."
"He's asking for $20 million, the negotiator said, with just a hitch in his professional manner. He sounded surprised.
"Yeah, and a letter from the White House," I said.
"It must say I am innocent," Garfanji shouted.
To this demand, the negotiator gave a quiet, self-assured laugh.
He'd been contacted through the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, he said. He reassured me that people were trying to help. Then he tried to patch our call through to my mother.
"Just bear with me." I heard a phone ring, and my mother said,
"Hello?"
in the tone of someone who was not, at that moment, dreading a call from Somalia. We'd caught her off guard. By then she had a command center established in the dining room. She kept a phone on the table, surrounded by notebooks and coffee mugs and lists of questions to ask. The phone had been souped up with caller ID, so I would know who was calling me, she said, and this ever-shifting mess remained on the table for most of my captivity.
"Hi, Mom. It's Mike."
"Hi, Michael. It's so good to hear your voice."
"I'm just calling, to say hello," I faltered, "and I miss you."
These phone calls, with their intense pressure and terrible connections, were masterpieces of understatement. Hearing her voice was like hearing music for the first time in weeks. I thought about my family and friends every day, but Mom's voice brought back the dry heat of Los Angeles and all the changing resonance of the word home. This old carousel of personal scenery, from Northridge to the beach to the sound of German voices in Berlin. My heart unraveled like a film reel.
"Are you healthy?"
she said. Yes, I said, terrified, but basically in good shape. A little food and a little water every day.
"After we talked last time," she said, "we continued to call that number they gave us, but there was never any answer."
I started to wonder if Garfanji was the same person as Omar, the high-voiced Somali on the bluff. He seemed to be a different man, but in the dark it was hard to tell. After more confused conversation, I worked up my courage to speak German, to test whether Garfanji knew the difference.
I babbled about a duffel bag I had left in a Nairobi hotel containing my U.S. passport and a laptop.
Somebody found the bag, Mom said in German. It was transferred to the U.S. Embassy.
That's very good, I said. So government people were taking care of her. It eased my mind. I could also tell from Garfangi's glazed expression that he wasn't following our chit-chat. I added in German that I had nothing against a military raid, regardless of what the pirates here say.
Yes, Mom said. Yes, exactly.
Most of the time she sounded earnest on the phone, striving to hear my voice or just to understand this freakish situation. But she could also be guarded and veiled. She had a poker hand to play. Now she exposed a tough lack of sentimentality, a seeming indifference to the danger of a rescue. I didn't mind at all. The pirates' erratic behavior had steeled us both against the prospect of a raid.
Time's off, Garfangi said. Come on!
I finished up and handed him the phone. The call had accomplished nothing. $20 million was a ridiculous outrage. Garfangi understood that as well as the rest of us. He started to scroll through some files on the phone menu and said, in an apathetic slur,
Your people have killed 9 of my people. If they try it with you, we will shoot you.
What happened? I said.
There was a rescue operation, he said vaguely.
I wanted to know if the hostages were safe, so I repeated my question from the phone call on the bluff. What happened to the hostages?
They were both killed.
My lungs constricted. My chest seemed to squeeze and bleed. Garfangi tapped his screen to open a sound file and tossed his phone in the dust. I didn't want to hear about dead hostages. But a news clip on Garfangi's phone explained in clear English that 2 aid workers held captive in Somalia since the fall of 2011 had been flown by U.S. helicopters, alive, to Camp Le Monnier in Djibouti. My heart thumped with hope.
I'm very sorry to hear that, I told Garfangi, and I think no one in that circle of pirates could tell how the phone had made a fool of their boss by revealing his poor command of English.
Chapter 11 My mother and the FBI in California ignored Garfangi's demand for a letter, but the way he insisted on a pardon from the president on embossed letterhead did suggest he was half insane.
We wondered if he was the same person as Omar, Mom said later.
Garfangi became an inconstant, flickering figure to me. I met Omar in the sunshine on a bluff, Garfangi in the sandy waste under a full moon. And in the panic of a hostage's mind, maybe one person could seem like two people, and two people could seem like one. Mohamed Garfangi, also known as Mohamed Osman Mohamed, invested in real estate, both in Galmudug and outside Somalia. He likes to drink, he likes women, and he likes to beat the shit out of people, a security contractor told me later. He's close to the Somali government, and he wants to be in the government, so he puts his men to work as if they were the government. That meant patrolling the oceans and cultivating a Coast Guard image off Somalia, as well as providing security forces for smaller Galmudug towns. He was a Suleiman, not a Sa'ad, but both clans belonged to a larger clan called the Habargadir. They could work together. Garfangi kept a private militia in Hobyo, but his pirates tended to be inland bandits and irregular fighters, closer to the violent highwaymen called Shifta than to fishermen. The word Shifta derived from another clan, the Mshifta, but referred to any roaming bandit in the great desert that extended from Somalia to Sudan and took in the whole of northern Kenya, according to Paul Theroux, who'd met them in southern Ethiopia. Garfangi hired men like that. A number of central Somali pirates, no doubt, were former fishermen who needed jobs, but most of the foot soldiers I met came from Galkayo or landlocked nomadic villages. They were children of the desert bush. One reason piracy spiked in the early 2000s, in fact, was that security forces in Puntland went unpaid, and so many of the gunmen simply turned to different work. Garfangi also played a social justice game, a Robin Hood gambit for popular support intended to blunt local opposition to his crimes. He paid doctor's bills in Hobyo. He made generous loans. He offered people jobs. He kept them from starvation.
There are no beggars in Hobyo, Gerlach told me. Garfangi is very popular there.
So from one point of view, Garfangi was a monster. From another, he was a social-minded capitalist working in tough terrain. I didn't want either manifestation talking on the phone to my mom. But her poise surprised the FBI. Even when a phone call took her by surprise, she snapped to attention. She amazed all of us, one agent said later. It didn't seem to matter how much stress or anxiety she had. She could switch it on or off. Once she got on the phone, she was totally on point. Mom was never aware of Garfangi as an individual boss. The name she heard most often on the phone was Abdi Yeri, but several bosses used that nickname, and Mom couldn't tell which boss was which. During a conference call with three top-ranking pirates, she tried to distinguish each voice, one at a time, without success. "They didn't want to talk," she said, "except through a translator, and I was shaking inside. But I figured if I burst out in tears, that wouldn't work. They had no compassion, so I tried to just keep to the subject and keep on repeating what I was trying to say. Sometimes I sounded like a broken record." She dealt with the stress on the tennis court. Golf had become her retirement game, but somehow tennis felt more satisfying while I was in Somalia. Between ransom calls, she reverted to her more strenuous sport. "I needed something to hit with a racket," she told me, "and I thought of the ball as Abdi Yeri's head."
Chapter 12. Plane visits over Hobyo became more common after the phone call. And for the next 2 weeks, at Mohammed's house, I made a strict habit of unfolding my hand-drawn map in the outhouse and flashing Morse code at the sky. The sound of aircraft tracing a wide arc overhead could lift my mood for hours. Otherwise, Mohammed's prison compound was a tedious and nasty solitary confinement, and in spite of the relative calm, I preferred the Italian ruin with Raleigh and Mark. I missed Raleigh's conversation. I missed the way he said, "We are prisoners," and explained things to me with one palm open, like an old Frenchman making an appeal. One afternoon in the first or second week of March, I heard a commotion on the porch and saw a black arm with a gold wristwatch point into my room. Ali Dulai. I sat in the mosquito tent with a notebook and pen. Dulai wanted to know from the guards why I wasn't ready to leave. With a wash of dread, I tossed my radio and notebooks into a plastic bag, and Dulai lurched in wearing his rifle. He threatened me with it and shook the curved ribs of the tent. There was no time to grab an important bag of clothes, and I left other things hanging or scattered around the room. Towel, toothbrush, leather jacket concealing my LED lighter. Since I was barefoot, I stopped to put on my shoes. Dulai pinched a slab of flesh in my side and twisted. "Go, go, go, go," he said. A white car waited in the road. I climbed in front and Dulai crammed into the rear. Other pirates glared at me from the back seat while we sped off, as if I were the source of their trouble. Dulai muttered something bitter and slugged me in the head. Soon another car caught up to us, churning dust. We bounced through the trackless bush, over ridges and rocks, and my head whanged with adrenaline. We arrived at some kind of gully south of Hobyo, another dry riverbed cut into the sand. Somalis piled out of the second car with equipment, pots, mattresses, weapons, and two other hostages made their way toward the wadi. Even at a distance, with blurry eyes, I recognized Raleigh and Mark. The Somalis flopped our mattresses at the foot of a crumbling 6-foot bank. A tree with its root system exposed in the wall of dirt stretched up a canopy of leaves. We had to lie beside the roots. Nervous birds fluttered and chirped overhead.
"Ali come get you?" said Raleigh.
"Yeah, I didn't have time to bring my clothes."
"What you got there?"
He nodded at my plastic bag. "Notebooks, a change of shorts."
"Mark also. Ali come in and say, 'Go, go, go.' I no listen, I take my time. I duck under Ali's arm," he said. "I got all my bags, but Mark have to go without these things."
"Why do you think we left in such a hurry?" I said.
"I not know."
The open bush struck me as a good staging area for a seal raid, less dangerous than a house with concrete walls. I didn't mind the prospect of my friends getting rescued, too. But Raleigh's face worked again with nervous anguish, maybe churning through his old, unchanging trenches of thought. At last, he made his declaration.
"Now we in the desert," he said.
A pirate came down to attach a blanket to the thorny tree branches over our head. "No blanket," I objected, meaning I didn't want the shade, but he insisted.
"Because Korax,"
he said, meaning sun, but I knew very well it wasn't because of the sun. 15 or 20 minutes later, we saw the glint of an aircraft to the south.
"Is it an airplane?" said Raleigh.
The Somali hadn't dangled a blanket on that side, so I mumbled, "It can see all three of us."
"It's too far, Mike Hill."
"I doubt that." A nearby pirate lit a cigarette using an LED-equipped lighter, so I bummed a smoke. When he obliged, I palmed the lighter. It would have been appalling manners anywhere else in the world, but the guard just nodded and smiled. There was no shortage of lighters in the camp. Now I had a flashlight again. Later, the pirates delivered thick, sturdy rubber thongs in a plastic package marked Made in Thailand. These Thai sandals replaced my shoes. We each received a pair, and we quibbled about the colors. Raleigh took yellow, Mark took orange, I took light blue. I explained to the pirates that because of Ali Dulai, we lacked other important items. Mark had no blanket, I had no coat. Tonight, cold, I told them. Desert, cold. Ha! Yes. Jacket coming? No problem. An hour later, I stood up to unhook the blanket from thorns in the tree. The Somalis stared. I handed it to Mark. The guards weren't about to confiscate the blanket from an old man, so after a while, a pirate came around to hang a new blanket, a pink one with flowers, to protect us from the sun. No blanket, I protested. Ha! Blanket! Jacket coming? No problem. None materialized, so by the end of the day, when sundown had cooled the air, I made the same complaint. No jacket! Problem! I said, and stood up to unhook the pink blanket from the tree. Tonight! Cold! Now we had a flashlight, two blankets, and nothing to block the view of another surveillance plane. Raleigh found it amusing, but he wiped his anguished face with one hand and said, with as much irony as force of habit, "Not make them angry, Michael." "Okay, Raleigh," I smiled. "I'll try." Chapter 13. We spent most of March in the desert bush, a week under the bird-infested tree, then more time under an arching white thorn bramble, a cluster of bushes so large that Raleigh could stand up inside it. We ate car-delivered pasta from plastic sacks and listened to the radio. The white thorns were supposed to shield us from overhead view, but I made a point of flashing the sky with my cigarette lighter in the morning and evening, away from camp, when I went to relieve myself in the weeds. Large planes cruised near us twice a week. Meanwhile, I scribbled in my notebook. Whenever a guard noticed, I told him that writing helped my wrist heal. Most of the pirates didn't give a damn, but I felt an instinct to keep the book hidden from Ahmed Dirye. One afternoon, the fading sunlight in our thorn bramble struck a fat bead of red sap bulging from a branch. I reached up from my mattress to inspect it. I'd never seen such a garnet color seep out of a plant before. These white thorn bushes were a source of myrrh resin. They grew across Yemen and Somalia and parts of Ethiopia. So the symbolism was about as subtle as a crucifix on Mexican velvet. But Raleigh said, "You know, Michael, in my country we say when you see thorns, you're going to heaven, but when you see flowers, then you're going to hell." I cleared my throat. "Well, we haven't seen a flower in months," I said. "We must be doing okay." "Yes, but..." He looked deeply troubled. He had just lost a rosary, a charm he'd rescued from the Aride. "I not know if I believe that now." Late one morning, we piled into a pair of cars and drove north for most of the day. Near sundown, we found a strange village near the coast, a near ghost town with widely spaced stone buildings. We parked outside this village, seemingly at random, and Ahmed Dirye climbed out to stand next to our car with his phone in the air, as if to check for signals. He gave me a rotten smile. "What are you doing?" I said. "No problem." The evening sun cast a sulfurous, green-yellow light. The pirates ordered Raleigh out and led him to a distant rise overlooking the ocean, just out of sight, where he had to dial his family in the Seychelles. But something went wrong with the connection. There seemed to be no other point to our endless drive, as if we'd come all the way up here to shake aerial surveillance to make a phone call to Mahé and signal free air without interference from international authorities. Only the line was busy. We continued north while the sun disappeared. In the dark, we crossed an expanse of desert on a straight highway made of powdery dust. Nothing seemed to exist in the damnable blackness outside, and we spent almost an hour on the same soft, unbending road. We drifted through the darkness on the soft dust, and the only feature I remember was another Land Rover, silver-painted but blank as a shipwreck, rearing into view so fast that our driver had to jerk the steering wheel. Abandoned. Someone else had tried to cross this desert, and failed. Late the same night, we drove into some hills and found a small cluster of huts. A herding family with curious children had prepared a place for us to sleep. In absolute silence, they watched us, these ragged foreign strangers, as well as the glamorous pirates with their guns.
A young girl climbed out of a squat hut the size of a doghouse where we were supposed to sleep, and her innocence, her thirsty, curious eyes broke me open like an egg. Her presence was a stark, astonishing exception to the anger and sarcasm I had felt aimed in my direction for more than 2 months. The night felt cold, windless, and silent, like no part of the world I'd ever seen.
"I've been here before," mumbled Raleigh after we settled into the little hut. "They take us here once before."
"Really?"
"Yeah, we come from Hobyo. Well, you live in that house."
"How long?"
5-6 days, like that. "We live in this hut. They make Mark pee in a bottle."
"Why?"
"They no let him outside."
We did get to leave the hut for bathroom breaks, but the emptiness of the countryside, whenever I did, alarmed me. The thorn bushes grew evenly spaced, brown instead of white, all about 3 feet high. There were no acacia trees, nothing remarkable besides the single far-flung breed of vegetation. Dying out here would be like drowning at sea. No one would even notice. We'd ventured beyond any landmarks that could help me orient my mind, and the long detour had frayed my sense of forward motion toward freedom. I just felt whirl and watery fear. I retraced our car trip and tried to fathom how I had arrived at this precise corner of the world, squatting near a thorn bush and flashing the sky with my ridiculous LED through a tube of toilet paper. On the first evening, I noticed a boy from the nomad family far off to one side. He'd followed me out here. Was he spying on my Morse code habits? I put the lighter away, but while I pissed in the weeds, I tried to weigh my ambition to write a unique book about Somalia against the devastation of this place.
"You have made a mistake," Boudin had said. "Mistakes are human."
On the second night, I went out to pee and noticed Ahmed Dirye and one other pirate pointing at the sky. One of them said, "Aeroplane," and after an hour they gave us an unexpected order to move. If dodging surveillance was the purpose of this detour, it had failed. Drones, or something, had pursued us. The pirates filled our car with mattresses, provisions, and cooking pots. Before we drove off, they searched my belongings. The LED cigarette lighter was in the pocket of my cotton shorts, which they didn't check. But Ahmed Dirye found my notebook.
"What is this?" he said, flipping through the tightly written pages.
"Practice. For my wrist." Abdul Nasser the Sahib backed me up. He argued my case in Somali. Ahmed Dirye gave me a bitter squint and rolled up the notebook to keep for himself. Weeks of therapeutic note-taking disappeared into his dusty bag.
"You respect me,"
he ordered and lifted his rifle.
"Oh, sure, boss," I said.
"You have a flashlight?" he asked in Somali. Someone translated and I said no, hoping they wouldn't search my shorts.
"Do you flash signals at satellites in the sky?"
he said.
"No." "If you flash signals at the sky, you will go down," said Ahmed Dirye.
He clicked the safety off his rifle and aimed the barrel at my chest.
"You, like Michael Jackson," he said. "Boom, dead."
"I understand."
"You respect me,"
he shouted.
"Oh, I respect you, boss." "Or boom, down."
"That's right." Reluctantly, to my considerable surprise, he returned the notebook. After nightfall, we took off under a fat moon. I recognized some of the silvered landscape in a few turns in the road. We started to speed along the straight, soft highway, and the driver bounced his wheels over stray rocks and jammed them into potholes. At last, the abandoned Land Rover loomed up again like a ghost. Raleigh cried,
"Oh, Jesus!"
and I grimaced. I thought we might flip the car. Instead, we slammed into a pothole and the left front wheel started to knock like a hammer. Ahmed Dirye told the driver to stop.
"We're fucked," I mumbled to Raleigh.
"Why you say that?" They hauled out a jack to lift the car. In the glare of a flashlight, they banged and twisted with hammers and wrenches until someone decided the wheel was fixed. The driver started again at a prudent speed. At last, still nervous about aircraft, I think, but convinced the wheel would hold, he stood on the gas. It was like floating through darkness again, fishtailing along that soft, ethereal highway with almost no feeling of gravity, not even traction, until the left wheel slammed into another hole, and we slid to a stop with the front axle leaning into the dust.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Raleigh said again.
"Told you we were fucked," I mumbled.
"What happened?"
"Raleigh, we lost a wheel." "Oh, Jesus."
Chapter 14. The sheer alarming stupidity of breaking off a wheel in the middle of the desert while running from a plane,
or a drone, or nothing at all, made the blood pound and slosh in my head. There had to be a limit to the volume of absurdity we could suffer. But no nightmare dissipated. No director lowered his jib crane to stop the idiotic film, and no American analyst seemed to recognize this car accident as a wide-open chance to rescue 3 stranded hostages. There is nothing like isolation in an atmosphere of electric violence for bringing before one's mind the understanding that the varnish of 2,000 years is so thin as to be transparent, wrote Hanley in Warriors. It is living in civilization that keeps us civilized. It is very surprising and alarming at first how swiftly it vanishes when one is threatened by other men, men of almost mindless resolve. The rest of the night was too dumb to explain, but I noticed that living among lunatic people had made me depressed and lunatic too. Hanley was right. Chaos was contagious. Pirates acted like criminals because they belonged to a criminal gang. While we sat in the car and waited for them to solve our asinine situation, I considered filching a Kalashnikov and solving it myself. I knew how to fire a weapon, but I wasn't a gunman, and without glasses I was half blind. Not a good combination, but idiocy, evil, and entropy fed on themselves like a hurricane over warm water. We returned to Mussolini's farmhouse the next day in another car and stayed about a week. One evening I went out to piss on the white rocks and noticed a line of sharp lights on the dusky water. I didn't mention them afterward to Raleigh because I didn't know what they were, but the next morning, after he and Mark had traded shifts outside, Raleigh said from his mattress, "Big ship, eh? What? Big ship in the water? Must be 50 meters like that." My heart fluttered. Did it have a flag?
I didn't see no flag.
I went out to the White Rocks myself and saw the vessel in broad daylight. A long, rusted, industrial-looking tub with a white bridge tower. Not a warship, not a freighter.
Angelo Say is from this pirate group, Raleigh said when I returned. He's hijacked.
Oh? Where's it from?
He say China.
Our relationship with this vessel developed in quick phases. First, we almost ran out of toilet paper. When we harassed Ahmed Dirye for more, he brought a Chinese-printed package of coarse, flat, folded stuff that was like paper towels. A few days later, I went for a shower in the white stone ruin, shadowed by a tall Somali named Issa. He told me to take a 1-minute shower, and while I tilted a plastic yellow jerry can full of water over my head, we heard the thump of a helicopter. I squatted behind a window of the ruin and watched. The wasp-like Hilo raced across the ocean and circled the ship. Issa waved me over to a wall where he stood holding his rifle.
"Get down!"
"What's the problem?" I said.
"NATO!" said Issa.
NATO was an all-purpose term for him, but NATO warships, in fact, worked only in the Gulf of Aden. The central Somali coast was monitored by the EU and a US-led naval group. Either way, it was interesting. I took my time hiding behind the broken front wall. That night, the pirates woke up Raleigh and me and hustled us into a car. We slept in the bush again with Ahmed Dirye's group of guards. Despite the pirates' efforts to keep us out of sight, we were harassed by aircraft for almost a week. In mid-April, after days of playing tag with surveillance planes in the bush, moving camp almost every night, we packed up in the dark and someone confiscated my notebook and radio. We drove for an hour and swapped vehicles among chaotic promises of freedom.
"Make a good telephone call," said one guard, obscurely.
"Adiga, free."
But there was no phone call. Instead, we sped toward the coast, and while I considered how it might feel to see my family and friends again, our driver steered crazily through the quiet houses of Hobyo, past dimly lit businesses and food shacks, where townspeople had gathered for late-night meals, and raced across the curving beach until the Land Rover came to a stop beside the water's edge.
"What are we doing?" I said. "Go, go, go, go!"
A skiff had drawn up under the moon. With our Thai sandals in our hands, we waded into lukewarm surf.
Pirates hopped in and told me to keep my pink blanket on my head while the pilot putted our skiff over crumbling whitewash, then higher swells, and around the seawall of rock, which Hamid, in a different lifetime, had insisted should be a loading pier. Then the pilot opened his throttle. He pushed us faster over the swells, up and down, causing the hull to slap. The blanket slipped off my head. We spent more and more time in the air between each wave.
"Slow down!" I shouted into the wind.
One pirate motioned as if he expected me to fix my pink head covering. For that, I would have to let go of the rail.
"Slow the fuck down!" I shouted.
The guards sat on a relatively stable bulkhead at the rear of the boat. We sat in the bouncing front. As we picked up speed, Raleigh shifted his weight off our bulkhead and squatted in the hull, holding the rail with one tight-knuckled hand. He used his knees to absorb the motion of the waves, and I tried to do the same, but we flew over another swell and the boat dropped away from my butt. Our bulkhead floated downward, leaving me in the air. When we came together again, the bulkhead hammered my spine, and pain shot from my tailbone to the base of my skull. I collapsed in the bottom of the skiff.
"I see you go down," Raleigh said later. "You go down like a leaf."
The pilot brought his speed under control. I managed to sit up, but my back throbbed. We pulled alongside the ship, and someone hurled a rope. The motion of the rolling hull, together with the waves, bounced our boat like an elevator, and a pirate showed us how to climb up. Raleigh did it first, standing on the skiff's prow, until a cutaway section of the gunwale lurched into range. Someone lifted him, he grabbed the gunwale, and a group of Somalis on the ship leaned over to grasp his shoulders and pull him aboard. I went up the same way. My back hurt, but the feeling of four men lifting me helpfully by the shoulders was a strange distraction. We found ourselves on a square deck lit with sharp white lamps, where dozens of Chinese-looking hostages lay on mats, arranged like dominoes. We had woken them up. The Somalis led us up a set of metal stairs and around to a forward section of the ship, where our two mattresses waited on the upper deck.
"Sleeping! Sleeping!" they said.
I certainly wanted to be unconscious, but my sore spine kept me aware of the ocean wind and a large number of spidery, unknown pirate guards. My notebooks and radio were gone. I wondered if the Somalis had moved us here to dodge a raid on land. If so, everything had to reset. Drones would have to find us again. Military plans, if any, would be redrawn. 3 wasted months in filthy prison houses and the desert bush had themselves gone to waste. My breathing came fast. I still wanted forward momentum, progress, logic, but instead I felt the edge of an emotional hurricane, the whistle of a gathering panic. Several hours earlier, I had indulged fantasies of freedom. Now I was injured and stuck on a ship. For the first time in Somalia, but not the last, I considered suicide. One common story about the trauma of gunfire is that you feel the bullets at first like a spatter of rain. The body registers a brush of metal but recoils from the rest of the damage in a merciful cloud of shock. The burning horror comes later. On the deck of this windblown vessel, I think my captivity first started to feel really hopeless. I couldn't see well in the dark. My back radiated pain, and with my notebook gone, I wondered how to sort out the confusion in my head. The notes also represented a small pile of work, so my time on land seemed triply wasted. And the confusion of ocean elements didn't help. I thought our vessel had started to move. Seagulls flapped into the wind under the strong deck lamps, not flying forward but scouting for fish in the artificial light. They seemed to glide and flap next to a sailing ship. I didn't realize the vessel was straining against its anchor chain in a stiff current. It wavered back and forth in the water, so the moon changed position in the sky, and the flapping of the birds with the shifting of the moon gave me the false impression that we were motoring north. This wrong idea infested me with a ferocious despair, and after a long sail to some forsaken part of the Somali coast, I thought, the pirates would no doubt assemble armies of men to defend this vessel of the damned. And it was time, at last, to check out. Part 4. The Ambiguous Asian Fishing Boat. Chapter 1. The illusion of sailing north persisted through the night. But I must have slept because the pirates had to wake us up in the morning under a bright sun. They said an American warship was standing 2 or 3 miles off. "Aeroplane," they added mysteriously, and ordered us down to the lower deck. The ship tilted back and forth on gentle swells. I moved gingerly for the staircase. But I wasn't fast enough for Abdinur, who shoved my shoulder, causing the pain in my spine to flare. Abdinur carried a machine gun with a heavy band of 30-caliber rounds, and we stood near a railing. I snapped, "Abdinur, if you do that again, I'll throw you over the side of this fucking ship!" And I meant it with all my heart. Lucky for both of us, Abdinur spoke no English. Downstairs, the pirates tossed our mattresses under a workbench-sized conveyor belt installed along the forward edge of the deck. Stuffed under this metal and rubber contraption, we would be harder for a drone to find. The Asian crew sat around the deck, watching us with young, gentle, curious faces. Some looked Southeast Asian, not Chinese. They seemed pleasant enough, but the back injury put me in a snappish and fatalistic mood. I squinted around the deck for the best place to jump. I did not want to be on the ship. White and aquamarine paint seemed to flake off the walls of the bridge tower across from us. The whole steel vessel thrummed with noise from a generator. My vision blurred the faces of the sailors, the sunlit rubber deck, and the rail of the ship, so escape was hard to assess. But I thought the cutaway section of the gunwale might work just fine. Maybe not now, not in front of everyone. Right now, my spine throbbed. I understood why back pain had driven my father to pills. A Filipino said, "Would you like some coffee?" "What?" "Oh, sure," I said. We received tin mugs of milky Nescafe. The Filipinos also handed around wads of fried dough, which had been sizzling in an electric wok. "Coffee and donuts," I muttered with approval. "Is good," Raleigh said. The more I squinted, the more the ship impressed me. It had no flies, it had working electrical outlets, and trickling water pumps. An old Honda motor loomed next to our conveyor belt, with curved metallic green surfaces like an antique fridge. Behind us, under a steel ceiling, in what English sailors would call the forecastle, many more hostages were crammed. Caged light bulbs burned on the steel ceiling inside. Clotheslines had been laced between the metal cages. I saw T-shirts, flowered surf shorts, peaked straw hats dangling by their strings. Everything swayed with the listing ship. The pacific tone of the crew's belongings salved my homesick brain. The ship was a tuna vessel called the Naham III, and it had sailed from Mauritius, an African island nation south of the Seychelles. The owners were Taiwanese. The crew came from China, Taiwan, Cambodia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam. The captain had been Taiwanese, but the captain was gone. Pirates had shot him. One Filipino, Ferdinand, had a calm face with pooling brown eyes. He seemed quiet and circumspect. His friend Arnel was lean and tall, with a brilliant smile. When he told us his name, he rolled the R, Arnel, so I could tell he was used to people from various parts of the world misunderstanding him. The Filipinos introduced us to a wiry Chinese man called Libo Hai, severe-looking, lean, with white flecks in his hair, who seemed to be in charge. Through Ferdinand's translation, he gave us a few basic facts. We were anchored near Hobyo, he said, in 18 meters of water, a little over a mile from shore. Oh, I said. Didn't we sail all night? What do you mean? Said Ferdinand. Where are we now? Yes, near Hobyo. We have been here since the end of March. Ferdinand pointed, and in the distance, I could just make out dirt-colored buildings clustered on the sand, spangled with bright reflections from the hot zinc roofs. In time, I learned to see the spindly shape of a cell phone tower, and the stranded fishing boat Hamid had pointed out from the beach, the Shifu One, with the Chinese hostage who had committed suicide. It was a gray, distant, tilted wreck. Interesting, I said. That ship is just like this one, Ferdinand told us. Really? Run by the same company? No, but also from Taiwan. I see. A cry went up from the men behind us in the forecastle.
Suban! Suban! Is what I heard, and everyone sprang up to grab a bowl and chopsticks. Two crewmen came down the steps with fresh-cooked pots of rice, and a Chinese man handed us each a green plastic bowl and a pair of chopsticks. Another took our bowls away again, but returned with breakfast, which involved Sichuan-spiced